The MOD boys are reading the stories. The payphones are jammed. So many hackers mill around the kiosk in the Citicorp atrium on this afternoon that you can't even see the phones. It's the first Friday of the month, and most of the MOD boys are at the 2600 meeting. Alan's here, visiting for a few days. Even Paul's here, home from college and hanging out. Somebody has arrived at the 2600 meeting carrying the issue of Newsweek with the article on ComSec, and the magazine gets passed around until it's downright grubby. The articles foment this sort of bad feeling, an unsettled, not quite rage, not quite amusement that they feel in their guts. Then some hacker says, "Who do those guys think they are?" Spoofing hackers is one thing. While it may hurt some feelings, no one gets really jammed up by it. But what kind of hacker turns on other hackers? It's a question that no one can answer. Suddenly the hackers rush the payphones in Citicorp, and in each little carol they launch a mass attack. Everyone dials the same Texas phone number, ComSec's 800 line. As a result, down in Houston, the phone bank lights up. Every line rings at once, and the ComSec crew doesn't know which phone to answer first. Of course, it doesn't really matter which one they answer, because all the taunting callers say the exact same thing, in the exact same maddening sing-song voice. "Hello? Is this ComSec? I have a victim here who wants to hire you." All afternoon, the lines stay busy at ComSec, so no legitimate client could possibly hope to get through. As soon as the ComSec crew hangs up on one caller, the phone lights up again. The kids at Citicorp have found an effective way to communicate their displeasure. The electronic heckling doesn't abate until the Manhattan meeting breaks up at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The kids wander off in little clumps, headed downtown to grab a cheap supper and to browse around in record stores. They have their monthly routine. First, they go to Around the Clock, a moody, dark East Village restaurant where rap music plays on the juke. A big color TV blares on the wall, and athletic waiters wear knit olive drab rave caps. The food is just this side of hippie. Whole wheat pita concoctions, three kinds of organic pancakes, healthy chicken soup. Mark usually orders two bowls. It settles his stomach. After eating, the boys wander across 3rd Avenue to Tower Books, where they flip through the endless shelves of hardcovers. Alan sees a phone receiver hanging on the wall and starts fiddling. It's the store's internal intercom system, and it can't make calls outside the building. But with a device he happens to carry, Alan coaxes a dial tone out of the receiver and immediately places a call to a friend in Pennsylvania. The device he uses is a tone dialer, which emits a noise that simulates the sound a payphone would recognize as coins dropping into a slot. It works like a bird call for computers. It was a pretty good hack, you'd have to admit, until all of a sudden a security guard comes over. He starts hassling them, wondering why some scruffy kid is fooling around with the store's phone. At that point, things take on the flavor of a segment from the Keystone Cops. Hackers scramble for the store's exit. More security guards appear from nowhere, and Alan is right in the middle of it. Then another hacker gets this bright idea to spray a mace-like substance into the air, as if it's air freshener. The hackers are pumped now, and they rush out into the New York night. Nobody gets caught. They have a good laugh about it. Dot annoy. That's how you type it. Period, no space, lowercase, annoy. Dot annoy. That's how all the MOD boys say it. Dot annoy. They should know, since they created the simple string of Unix commands that comprise dot annoy. In the MOD vernacular, dot annoy is both a noun and a verb. Here's an example of how you dot annoy someone else. First, log into Alan's Unix computer. Then, leapfrog over to the Apple computer that's hooked up to it. Next, pick a lamer who deserves a taste of dot annoy. Find his name in the database. Call up the lamer's entry and execute the dot annoy program. It's easy. This will instruct the Apple computer to follow the simple software program that Alan wrote. Let's say the lamer's phone number is 212-555-1234. You simply type in the phone number, and the program does the rest. While, colon, do, cu, 1-212-555-1234. Done. Looks pretty innocuous, but the purpose is anything but. This little string of commands instructs Alan's computer to use its modem to call the lamer's phone. Now you can expect the lamer to answer the phone, then hang it up, because no one is on the other end. This is where dot annoy gets ingenious. The MOD users add a simple command to the dot annoy program to make it repeat endlessly. Over and over, the computer will redial. All you have to type at the top of the dot annoy commands is this: no h up dot annoy ampersand. That command tells the computer the program does not end at a hang up. Accept no hang up. Keep dialing until another modem answers. So as soon as the lamer's receiver returns to the cradle, the Apple will call him again, looking for a modem. It has to. The lamer will answer again, then hang up. The Apple will call again. hang up again. Call, hang up, call, hang up, call, 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 call. Execute this plan at the beginning of a long holiday weekend, say 4th of July, because then the lamer can't seek assistance from the business office until Monday. You won't have to do another thing. Not after that initial instant when you call up the lamer's file to execute the .annoy command. That ampersand at the end of the no HUP command is Unix speak, for allowing the program to run in the background. In other words, the MOD computer can be used for other things while the .annoy program runs. You've automated the job of harassing your quarry. It's going to be a long weekend for the lamer. He will go crazy. The lamer will want to cry. The lamer will have a lot of explaining to do to his parents. Even after he's smart enough to answer the phone with a modem, the torture continues. Because as soon as the modem-to-modem connection is broken, that is, as soon as the lamer hangs up, the hell starts again. And best of all, the lamer will not be able to resist the trap. Time and again, he will pick up that ringing phone, because he will just want to stop the noise. Too bad he can't. The MOD boys would get really cute and add refinements to the torture. One twist is called Mr. Ed. Invoke Mr. Ed, and Alan's computer would call the target and speak directly to him. Alan's computer, which has audio capability, would blare out, "Hello, Wilbur," over and over. The MOD boys rely on the .annoy repertoire when dealing with the Texans, of course. But they also attack bystanders. Any hacker who has crossed them, any hacker who has the misfortune to be labeled lame, is prey. The first victim was an old Boy Scout acquaintance of Alan's, back from the days when Alan was striving for Eagle Scout. Now the database has dozens of names. The database is the key to .annoy. You can't .annoy someone unless you know a few salient facts. Hacker handle, which leads to real name, which leads to real phone number, which leads to local phone switch. Hence, the database. The list gets a little out of control, though. The MOD boys are a little obsessive about it, investigating the people on the list and then adding to Lamer's records information about street addresses, previous addresses, cable and pair number, known relatives, best friends, even anecdotal material about Lamer's personal habits. It pays to know. A lot of people say the MOD boys have become bullies. The boys aren't listening to that kind of sour grapes talk, though. The MOD database resides on Alan's Apple, accessible through Alan's Unix, which has become the MOD boys' electronic clubhouse. Alan has renamed the bulletin board ModNet. While every hacker in America knows about the existence of ModNet, very few have access to it. All the MOD boys have accounts, and they keep their most top-secret privileged information stored on ModNet. Everybody knows about the database. Rumors get around. The existence of the .annoy database is what really freaks people out, though. What if Alan got arrested, and that information fell into Secret Service hands? That file contained explicit biographical information on dozens and dozens of hackers around the country, around the world. It was a blueprint for the whole underground. The mere possession of such damning information seemed like blackmail. It made other hackers frantic. Any hacker would kill to get into ModNet. Good luck. Besides the database, what was actually archived on ModNet was a rather eclectic compilation of data. There were loads of files about technical aspects of hacking phone computers. There was the history of MOD in its entirety. There was also a history of the Knights of Shadow, a Rosetta Stone of sorts about an early band of hackers that spawned Lex Luthor and his LOD. There's a wire service story about the disposition of the legal case against one Peter Salzman, a.k.a. Pumpkin Pete. The MOD boys also did a fair amount of stargazing. They kept entries on certain celebrities, those credit histories that John would look up on a whim. Geraldo's financial profile was there. So was David Duke's. So was John Gotti's and Julia Roberts. And Winona Ryder's. Mad Magazine founder William Gaines was also in the pantheon of celebs because John had a vague plan to call him and ask for a job. So was Christina Applegate, a TV actress on whom Chris Goggins was said to dote. The MOD boys had been letting it be known that they'd call up Miss Applegate pretending to be Chris. "Maybe you saw my photo in Newsweek, babe," the faux Chris supposedly told her. The real Chris was just sick about it. The real Chris, in fact, knew all about the ModNet database, all about what those New York boys were up to. It seemed that one of Alan's pals, a Houston hacker who we'll call the Dentist, was an authorized ModNet user. The Dentist also fed information to the Texans. The Dentist was a double agent. The Dentist told the guys at ComSec all about his account on ModNet. The Dentist was anxious to please. "Give me the account," said Chris. "Well, let us take a look at it," said Chris. "Well, come on," We won't do anything, Chris said. The dentist, who'd been hanging out a lot in CompSec's office lately, shares. Pizza boxes and Coke cans litter the office. Full-bellied and full of steam, the CompSec boys sign onto their IBM 386 tower computer and call ModNet. Chris jokes about it. Oh, no. The lame guys from Texas break into MOD's computer. He's really pretty pleased. The CompSec modem places the call, and on the first ring, the ModNet modem answers. Connection. Here's what the CompSec boys see on their monitor. ModNet. Please use lowercase when logging in. If you are new here, log in as new. Password, new. ModNet, 2400 baud login. Dentist. Dentist password, XXXXXX. Current time is 2103. Security password. Unix System 5, release 3.51M. ModNet. Copyright, 1984, 1986, 1987, 1988. AT&T all rights reserved. Last login. No mail. MODnet, 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 MODnet. MODnet Unix System VO. Your mailing address is MODnet exclamation mark dentist at uunet.uu.net. Extension 222 has 0 voicemail messages. Extension 911 has 0 voicemail messages. ModNet $. The last line is the prompt. It's prompting the CompSec boys to issue a command. Usually the first command you type whenever you get inside a Unix system is ls. That command lists all the subdirectories and files and tells whether you, the user, are authorized to read them. Now the dentist does not have the highest level of access. He's not even a member of MOD. He's more of a hanger-on than anything else. Most of ModNet's super-secret delicacies are beyond his reach. He is not authorized to get into the .annoy database, for instance. This minor problem is no surprise to Chris, however. Not only did he anticipate the limited usefulness of the dentist's account, but Chris has a plan to surmount the problem. The plan can be summarized in 2 little words. Finger bug. That phrase, fraught with all the innuendo that any teenager could hope to convey, is the name of one of the better-known security holes in the Unix operating system. First, you must know what a finger is. Finger is a common Unix command that tells you whether a certain user is logged in on your system. You finger, or locate, the user. For instance, if you want to find out if a user named Cool Dude is logged into the system, you typed modnet, $, finger, Cool Dude. In response, you might see Cool Dude's name, his real name, the date and time he last logged in, is he logged on now, and whether he has any unread electronic mail. In addition, the finger bug would show you Cool Dude's .plan file, that's .plan, of course, which typically is an autobiographical description of the user you want to locate. Think of the .plan file as a user's high school yearbook entry. I'm a cool dude. I love Depeche Mode. I drive an IBM 386 clone. My favorite food is cheese waffies. Death to lemurs and rodents. The finger bug exploits a well-known vulnerability in certain Unix systems. The bug temporarily gives you root access to anyone invoking the finger command. Let's say you wanted to read a file called cooldude.mail. Using another string of commands, you just link cooldude.mail to .plan, hence ln-s, cooldude.mail.plan. Chris uses the finger bug to read the electronic mail of all the MOD boys. He reads all of John's mail, and then copies it for later gloating. From the wing. To outlaw corrupt. Subject, username. I got a username if you don't have this one. McCrease, PW, Blue Moon on TimeNet. Also got TNX MD Hit 01, PW Uphone Tran. Jumps into some sort of X-modem shit. Well, I'm out of here. The wing of MOD. Most of the stuff, if you must know, is pretty dull, pretty weak, pretty, well, unreadable, like most people's email. But it's the principle of the thing. CompSec's broken into MOD's hideaway. Chris efficiently makes copies of all the files, so he'll have a record of his exploits. Of course, it would be awesome to have also infiltrated the database. Can you imagine? Bet you could change your own phone number so that when those New York idiots tried to dot-annoy you, they ended up calling themselves. But the CompSec boys couldn't get into the database because, well, they couldn't even find it. They didn't know that the database is housed on a totally separate computer, the Apple. Oh, well. Chris would like to keep the buffered trophies proprietary to CompSec. They'd be useful to show prospective clients. These kids think they're so smart, don't you know? They even have a file called ComSuck. But look at this. Looks like your computer system is one of the ones they can infiltrate. Your system is one of many in a file called MODOWND. Get it? MOD owned. However, Kenyon has to go and slip the copies to Alfredo. Couldn't resist. Alfredo publishes the scandalous information in his electronic newsletter, The Nasty Journal. It publishes sporadically. Twice, in fact. In its final report, Nasty Journal No. 2, publisher, editor-in-chief, and staff writer Alfredo De La Faye scores a beat with this exclusive scoop. During the past few months, Nasty has taken a small vacation. During that time, MOD has bragged about crushing Nasty with my thumb. Well, it just got to be unbearable. It's time for us to show the little shits for what they really are. Let me start off by recapping the situation. MOD claims to be so damn untouchable. They also claim ModNet and their Unix are so damn secure. Heh, what a joke. During the time Nasty has been crushed, we have been monitoring ModNet. All of the mail, files, password files, messages, and lovers' quarrels have been intercepted. Yes, we own MOD. Everything, I mean everything, is going to be made public, including, but not limited to, MOD's private database. Nice going, Alf. You might expect the MOD boys to be swooning from the embarrassment of it all. They don't swoon. In fact, they issue spin control on the incident. The whole thing was a trap, don't you see? To lure the ComSec crew. MOD knew the dentist couldn't be trusted. They wanted ComSec to disseminate far and wide evidence of MOD's incredible prowess in accumulating information. Bad publicity is still publicity, isn't it? One day, John Lee has an ingenious idea for pranking the Texans. Why didn't he think of it before? He puts his plan into action during the long, hot summer of 1991. He keeps his mind off the lack of air conditioning in the brownstone apartment on Kosciusko Street. The mechanics of the spying are fairly simple. John logs into the southwestern bell switch that controls ComSec's phone service in Houston. Then John types commands to ask the switch if any of ComSec's phone lines are off the hook. If they are, then John would know that a conversation is underway right now. A phone line is in fact off the hook, so he issues another command, just like an operator would, to seize control of the line that carries the call. That easily, he splices himself into the ongoing conversation. There's a quiet click on the line, but it's not the sort of noise you'd notice unless you were waiting for it. And no one at ComSec has any reason to believe that calls are being tapped. John starts to eavesdrop routinely. That was the way to find out what the enemy was up to. A way to anticipate the Texans' every move before it was made. So here's John, listening in on ComSec's lines one afternoon, when the security firm gets a call from a hacker named Craig Nydorf. It's safe to say that no hacker was more famous than Nydorf in 1991. That was because Nydorf had beaten the feds at their own game a year earlier. In the months since, his legal fight had become legend. For years to come, wary prosecutors who were considering indicting hackers would caution one another to make sure their cases were airtight, so they could avoid pulling another Nydorf. The co-editor of the electronic magazine Frack, Nydorf went on trial in Illinois in the summer of 1990, charged with fraud. The alleged crime was possessing and publishing an allegedly proprietary phone document in an issue of Frack. The government argued that the information was worth thousands of dollars, based on estimates from the phone company. But midway through the trial, the defense showed that the document's so-called proprietary information was publicly available. Belcore sold the information to anyone who had $13 to pay for a technical article. Humiliated, the federal prosecutors in Chicago dropped the charges before the case reached a jury. Yes, Nydorf was a hero to some hackers, but his notoriety also made him a target for anyone in the underground determined to make a name for himself in cyberspace. Now, in the middle of a workday, Chris Goggins has answered the phone at ComSec's end of the call, and Nydorf is on the other end. John eavesdrops noiselessly. He's so quiet he isn't even breathing as loudly as he normally would. The phone call is just a friendly chat, but today Nydorf is frankly annoyed. The problem is that anonymous callers have been phoning Nydorf at home and harassing him over the line. He doesn't know who is responsible, but he wants the prank calls to stop. They're really annoying.
Sounds like they're doing stuff along similar lines as what they're doing to us, Chris says.
Someone just called at my dad's house in Virginia, Nydorf says. Chris is not surprised. He's outraged on behalf of this potential client, of course, but definitely not surprised. He even has a theory about who might be behind the calls.
Sounds like corrupt, Chris says,
recounting his suspicions that John Lee has also been pranking him in Houston.
Sounds like something he would do.
At that moment, a second phone line rings in Houston. Another incoming call for ComSec. Chris asks Nydorf to hold on a minute, then answers the other line. The voice on the second phone line says to Chris, "Yeah, that does sound like something I would do." John couldn't resist. This was just so good. In an instant, the reality hits Chris. He can barely believe it. The hackers are bugging the hacker trackers. And then calling up to boast about it. Impossible, but true. Chris hangs up on John, gets back on the other line with Nydorf, and barks tersely, "They're listening to our call." When he gets off the phone, Chris is so mad he can't think straight. John Lee has been eavesdropping on ComSec's private phone calls for how long? How often? What has he heard? What has he told his little friends up there in MOD? If this got out, ComSec would be a laughingstock. Would you hire a computer security company that couldn't keep its own phone line secure? Chris calls the FBI. He leaves the ComSec office, goes to a payphone, at least this line is secure, and calls an agent in Washington, a name Craig Nydorf gave him, and tells the FBI agent that he has proof that hackers have been illegally listening in on his phone calls. Of course, Chris has no idea that the Secret Service and New York Telephone have been keeping tabs on every electronic move that John Lee and Julio Fernandez make. He has no idea that an investigation is already underway. Chris has no idea that Secret Service agent Rick Harris would quickly learn from his FIBI cohorts of the Texans' cooperation and view ComSec's involvement as a nuisance. It would not help the government get convictions if the U.S. Attorney's Office had to explain to a jury that the Southwestern Bell intrusions are nothing more than a pissing match among a bunch of kids. Chris figures he's a businessman and has a legitimate right to protection. He tells the FBI in Washington that ComSec can't have hackers listening to calls from clients who are trying to outwit hackers themselves. The FBI agent says he is very concerned. A few weeks later, Chris and Scott go to the FBI's Houston office to discuss the full details of their beleaguered situation. They name names, MOD names. They tell the agent that MOD has access to Southwestern Bell switches. Chris thought the agents looked rather shocked. But when the agents reported back to the office, they learned that a lot of people already knew about this electronic gang war. In fact, the FBI and the Secret Service were wrangling for control over the investigation of the case against John and Julio. Suddenly, everyone seemed to know what a switch is. Representatives from the U.S. Justice Department's newly created Computer Crimes Unit traveled from Washington to New York City to be briefed. The FBI wanted to run the show, but the Secret Service was already in place. They're rivals. It got heated. The subtext was clear. This was going to be a big case, and everybody wanted a piece of it. This case could be a groundbreaker. Why did the case suddenly interest even the highest levels of federal law enforcement? Why did this pattern of intrusion, no different really from what the MOD boys had been doing to New York Telephone's computers 2 years ago, now capture the imaginations of the best minds at the U.S. Justice Department? Suddenly it dawned on everyone that this was a whole new area of crime. This was the future in law enforcement. It was going to explode, and they had to get ready. This case didn't seem to be only about hackers in the coming information highway. It was about any criminal out there who would have the wherewithal to use high-tech sophisticated communications to try to outwit the government and commit crimes. This case became a first, the first ever of its kind, and it would set the precedent for years to come in how the government tracked techno-literate criminals. For the first time in U.S. history, the authorities wanted to put wiretaps on computers. This wouldn't be called a wiretap, no, it would be called a data tap. They wanted to identify the boys' every keystroke. Of course, for starters, the government also wanted to put traditional wiretaps on John and Julio's phones. With evidence from the DNRs, from the traces Kaiser did in the spring, and from phone toll records that revealed every number John and Julio dialed, a judge was convinced to authorize the wiretaps and the data taps. The Justice Department in Washington, D.C. decided that the Secret Service would run the show, setting up a monitoring headquarters called a wire room. The FBI would assist. That was a big victory for Agent Rick Harris. Then reality hit everyone. Getting a federal judge's permission was the easy part of this task. In a normal case, the Secret Service might need a modest amount of equipment to conduct a wiretap on a phone. A few tape recorders, some headphones, a couple of agents working 12-hour shifts. Oh, and a notepad for the agents to jot down interesting things they hear and want to remember. This was no normal case. To set up the simultaneous phone modem taps in the MOD case in 1991, the Secret Service first obtained an entire suite of rooms in the World Trade Center, where the New York City office was already headquartered. One-of-a-kind, high-fidelity digital data intercepting equipment was brought up from Washington. More was designed and built on site for the case.
A guy with a soldering iron and wire clippers worked away on the stacks of machinery that challenged the strength of office-issue tables that had to support the weight. The bank of equipment was 15 feet long, a massive electric shop mess of cords and wires and blinking lights, audio components, and big disk drives to store information. Shelves of dinner plate-sized storage tapes lined the walls, and a computer anchored it all, keeping track of the kind of information a DNR could accumulate: number dialed, duration of call, time, and day. The wiretaps on the phones were easy to operate. The government had been doing it for years. And three copies of every phone call were simultaneously recorded, so that the court could seal one copy as insurance against tampering, the FBI could seal a second copy for its archives, and the prosecutors could use the third copy to build their case. This configuration of contraptions and tapes and copies of tapes and copies of copies was confusing enough, what with the government monitoring two phones at once. Three copies for Julio's calls, three copies for John's. But the data taps, now that took some doing. You were trying to intercept data from two different computers talking to each other and expecting no interference. And you were not 100% sure about the configuration of those computers. Each computer had its own unique modem, and modems are quirky. You've got to insert another device into the middle of this intensive data transaction. When the modem on John's computer meets another modem, it sends out a signal. Hi, this is who I am. This is my baud rate. This is how I send information. Let's shake hands. Pleased to meet you. Beep. If you want to hear the modem's conversation, you've got to use some intercept that will do the job without interfering with the idiosyncratic and sensitive signals. It's like breaking the infrared beam of a burglar alarm without tripping the system. Don't mind me. I'm just standing here quietly. Good luck. It took a few days to get the data taps running properly. A few more to capture a reliable stream of data without causing the modems to crash. Then it took a few days to tune the data taps to pick up information that actually meant something and didn't just appear to be a string of random gibberish. But a little welding here, some clipping of wires there, and the federal government's fledgling foray into data entrapment was underway. Then John got a new modem. Everything crashed. Out came the soldering irons. There was a lot to keep up with, because the boys were supplying an enormous amount of phone and data conversations to eavesdrop on. Dozens of calls a day. The output was phenomenal, and the authorities were going through storage disks like so many dishes at a diner. Tom Kaiser went downtown for a consultation one day, and what stuck in his mind was the sheer number of people milling around the place, the teams and teams of agents that the government had assigned to pick up Tom and Fred's original investigation. Rick Harris had to work 24-hour days to supervise the government operation. But since he came from a long line of volunteer firefighters, he jumped to the call. It was in his genes. When the alarm goes off, he slides down the pole. Under Harris's direction, 24 agents worked 12-hour shifts for weeks, listening to the intercepts, analyzing the information, transcribing it, keeping up a steady flow of the day's input, so that Prosecutor Fishbein would have the ammunition he needed to convince a judge to keep the whole operation up and running for a while longer. It was a wildly expensive undertaking. Every 10 days, Fishbein had to go back to court, show the judges examples of the information being culled, convince him that the government taps were obtaining valuable evidence of illegal activities that outweighed John and Julio's rights to privacy on their own phones and their own computers. Amid all this activity, Fishbein and Harris held daily meetings, in the morning, at supper, after midnight. They'd talk about the bits and pieces of information they were gathering. They'd get a judge's permission to send transcripts to computer experts for analysis. They began to realize just how widespread the intrusions were, just how knowledgeable John and Julio were about computers. And Fishbein saw other names showing up in the transcripts, names of people that John and Julio talked to all the time: Mark A. Bean and Eli Lidopoulos. When he asked Harris about the names, Harris seemed to know who these boys were. But by then, the sheer mass of voice and data interceptions was overloading the team. They could hardly keep up. But they had to keep up, because they were committed now, in up to their elbows. They were behind schedule in numbering and cataloging the data sessions, and the government wouldn't know what actually happened during those sessions until somebody listened to them. What were the kids saying on the phone now, anyway? What were John and Julio up to? What if John and Julio crashed a switching center that controlled the entire state of Texas? What if the Secret Service were monitoring during the crash, but didn't get a chance to listen until 3 days later? How would that look? Harris and Fishbein didn't get much sleep. Down in Texas, the informers had made an arrangement. Chris had worked out a deal with the FBI that enabled him to tip off the feds any time the MOD boys were active. If the New Yorkers called ComSec, for instance, Chris immediately left his office, walked down the street to a certain payphone, and called Washington. The payphone seemed secure, but the FBI agent had told Chris never to mention the agent's name on the line, just to be careful. Chris thought the agent was leery that the MOD boys might have bugged the phone somehow and would prank the agent at home if they knew his name. Mr. FBI Elite. Mr. FBI Elite. The ComSec crew didn't stop there, though. ComSec was a computer security firm, so it was ComSec's job to inform other companies if their computer systems were insecure, right? Might not be a bad way to drum up new clients, come to think of it. In the fall of 1991, Scott Chasen phoned Information America, the company that collects tidbits of personal information about people's employment histories and finances. Scott introduced himself to the company's security department, then said, "Do a search in your system for my name. Do you see all the credit reports pulled under my name?" The Information America official searched and found 10 recent requests for Scott's credit reports. In other words, 10 people had logged in to inquire about Scott. That was pretty unusual, because an individual's credit report usually gets pulled only if the individual has invited scrutiny by applying for a mortgage or more credit cards. Some people's reports don't get pulled 10 times in their lifetimes.
"You guys have got to do something about this," Scott said, explaining that he suspected MOD members had been fiddling with his credit information in an attempt to harass him.
The security official at Information America was astounded. "How did they get into our system?" "Easy," Scott said. "The same way they've been breaking into TRW, Southwestern Bell, and the Bank of America." "They have broken into the Bank of America?" "Oh, yeah," Scott said. "We've been watching them." Scott said he had evidence the MOD boys had infiltrated a worldwide network that computers used to pass information to one another. He said MOD had access through the network to the private transactions of dozens of the world's largest corporations. MOD not only had access to delicate corporate secrets, but it also had the ability to upset a billion-dollar company's financial stability with a single keystroke. How did they do it? Scott explained it with one word. TimeNet.
13. Parmaster had this special password. Nobody knew where he got it or when. It was just part of the Parmaster myth. But man, the things he could do with that password. Parmaster's real name was Jason Snitker. He only happens to be in New York because he's on the lam. No lie. He's actually being pursued by the Secret Service. Back in 1988, Jason was charged in Monterey, California, where he attended high school, read way too many spy thrillers, and discovered Joe Cola prior to becoming a fugitive, with breaking into a Citibank computer. The particular computer he was charged with breaching was one that assigned debit card numbers to customers of a Saudi Arabian bank. While he was in the computer, Jason decided to take a souvenir, approximately 10,000 valid debit card numbers, some credit line. Almost immediately, those card numbers started to turn up on bulletin boards from California to Texas. Free money. Hackers all over America started charging their long-distance calls to Saudi Arabian debit cards. It was like Robin Hood sharing the spoils with his merry men. And by the time Citibank caught on, who knew how much money had been lost? When they finally caught up with Jason, the bank was asking for $3 million in restitution. Good luck. Jason turned himself in on December 12, 1988. And that might have been the end of it, since he was a juvenile. Community service, don't do it again, blah, blah, you know the routine. But Jason was an impressionable teenager. Remember the spy novels? He believed he knew too much. Jason saw a lot of secrets in cyberspace during his hacking days, including what he said were government secrets, like the killer satellite. That's how people say Jason described it, the killer satellite. According to documents he found on TRW's internal computer network, in addition to being a national credit reporting agency, TRW is a giant defense contractor. The killer satellite, once deployed, could focus a death ray on other spy satellites, taking them out of commission. This was top, top secret stuff, Jason told people. It made the debit card numbers look lame. Maybe the government would liquidate Jason to keep him quiet. Maybe it was all a big conspiracy, and he was the only one who knew the truth. He could really get hurt. So Jason freaked. No way he was going to wait around for jail time. Did Lee Harvey Oswald ever see jail time? So Jason split, and now he's in New York, hiding out around Coney Island. The Secret Service had gotten the tippies in the area. Ditto the New York State Police. One day, a state police senior investigator goes to a 2600 meeting at Citicorp and insinuates himself among the potted plants on the balcony. The investigator is looking for Jason. He even brings a camera and takes surveillance shots, but Parmaster doesn't show up. Some other people have found Jason, though. He's hooked up with MOD. It's only natural that the best hacker on the West Coast should hang with the best hackers on the East Coast. It turns out they have a lot in common and go way back. Jason can't even remember the first time he encountered Mark,
He knows it was on Altos. All Mark cared about then was hacking the phone system. That was cool, Jason. To each his own. Now, though, the MOD guys had mastered the phone system and were looking for new terrain to conquer. TimeNet had potential. And Jason had the password. One day, he shares it with Mark during a trade. And that's how it starts. The password got Mark, John, and Julio into the heart of TimeNet. In the past, they'd had limited access to this global electronic data network. For years, the MOD boys had been collecting TimeNet dial-ups, connecting to its system, then leapfrogging into other states or countries. It was kind of like long-distance telephone service for computers. Free. In fact, while on the run, Jason had created a special account that would allow anyone, anywhere, to use TimeNet free. You'd get your computer to call a local dial-up, then the computer would ask for a login, and you'd type parmasterx75, and then a password, parmaster equals TimeNet God, to prove you really were the authorized user. Too cool. Word spread throughout the underground. It was operable for a whole year, enhancing Parmaster's image more than a PR firm could. Although the Parmaster Network user ID enabled the MOD boys to use TimeNet, it kept them from tinkering with its engine, kept them out of the guts of this enormous repository of information and power. But with Parmaster's new privileged password, the MOD boys could explore dozens of dedicated subnetworks that the system links. TimeNet customers are big corporations and government agencies with far-flung computers that need to talk to one another. Now the MOD boys could get into TimeNet just like any engineer at Martin Marietta Missile Group could. Just like a vice president at Bank of America could. Just like a general in the U.S. Air Force could. One thing separated the MOD boys from those other users, though. Most TimeNet customers log into only a tiny section of the system, into the subnetwork that houses their organization's business. The MOD boys were different kinds of customers. They had the power to run rampant through everybody's networks. Not right away, of course. At first, the MOD boys were simply blown away by the immense possibilities that lay before them. Sure, they'd hacked other big systems. They'd mastered the nation's phone system, hadn't they? But TimeNet's sphere of influence and importance is much broader than the phone systems. TimeNet exists at the very vortex of cyberspace. Billion-dollar financial transactions, top-secret plans for fighter jets, the confidential credit history of the President of the United States. It's all there, sucked into cyberspace and rushing past at an incalculable rate. Information rockets through the pipeline that TimeNet controls. Information packaged as precise units of data that zip from one user's computer screen to another halfway around the world. If you know the right commands, if you execute them at the right instant in time, then you can examine the data as it zips past. You can x-ray the units. You can become an electronic voyeur. You can, quite simply, know all the world's business. Jason's password was the first step. It is Mark, of course, who figures out the next step. He logs into TimeNet day after day, obsessively, unable to take a break to sleep or eat, fueled by cigarettes and Coca-Cola. He sees a nearly infinite system, a system that is beautiful because of its endless complexity, a system that defies explanation, spiraling forever outward, like the Big Bang, always changing as new software and new hardware come online. He sees a system that he alone might understand. Who knows more about so many different networks? AT&T employees only know about AT&T. New York telephone engineers only know about New York telephone. A TimeNet technician is just as myopic. But Mark sees how all the systems work and how they all fit together into a universe that he alone has conquered. Mark synthesizes that information into a worldview that allows him to go further, intuitively hacking. And that's why he never doubts that he will master TimeNet. One day, Mark finds a few old computers called PDP-10s, old mini-computers owned by TimeNet and used by the company's technical staff to store administrative manuals. This is a find of unbelievable good luck. Imagine being an archaeologist, patiently digging through layers and layers of alluvium, and then you find the Rosetta Stone. All the pieces are in front of him, but he doesn't know how to read it. Not yet. John and Julio have told Mark they've heard that TRW operates its own subnetwork somewhere on TimeNet. It makes sense for TRW to exist on TimeNet, because car dealers and loan officers and bill collectors from all over the country had to get into the TRW system quickly to look up credit histories. All those TRW customers wanted a local phone number to dial to get in. TimeNet, with dial-ups in every major city in America, was the conduit. John and Julio gave him a number of valid usernames. Who knew where the names came from? Maybe a garbage dumpster. But they don't know what to do with the stuff. But Mark does. He logs in, then types TRWNET. And there he is. He's in the subnetwork. He gets a prompt. TRWnet, caret. He starts testing certain ubiquitous commands. He types DIR, and sure enough, a directory of file names appears. He types type file name, and the contents of the file in question fill his laptop screen. Mark discovers that TRW has its own PDP-10 computer on TimeNet. He starts looking around and he finds a list of every account name and password. The subnetwork has files and directories and packets of information that you can send back and forth between users' computers. The subnetwork uses exactly the same hardware as the rest of TimeNet. If Mark can understand the architecture of TRWNet, by extension, he'll know everything there is to know about the whole TimeNet system. So that's exactly what he does. He breaks TRWNet down to its component parts and figures out how each one works alone, then how they work together. He learns the lyrical acronym for TimeNet's whole gorgeous architecture, ISIS, the Internally Switched Interface System. ISIS is made up of nodes, which are really just computer processing chips. Each node is loaded with slots, which run software applications. For instance, every slot has software used for troubleshooting or debugging. The software is called the Dynamic Debugging Tool, or DDT for short. Get it? A debugger called DDT? Computer people have the best sense of humor. He learns that there are supervisor nodes. They are to TimeNet what switches are to New York Telephone. Supervisor nodes are like traffic cops, routing packets of data to their destinations and keeping track of what's going on in the rest of the network. With the manuals he got from the PDPs, Mark has a blueprint, and he learns about the software tools that TimeNet technicians use to keep each node running. It's a great system because each engine he explores is loaded with its own full set of software tools, like DDT, right there in the slots. One of those tools is aptly named X-Ray, which allows TimeNet workers, and now Mark, to look inside each packet of data as it whizzes by. He learns about every aspect of the network, just as he did with the telephone system, and there's no stopping him. He hits TimeNet at least 10 times a day, logging what the government will later say was an astronomical 23,314 minutes of network time. Mark gets a stack of floppy disks that he calls the main 10. He has copied all the information from the TimeNet manuals onto the floppies and carries them around. He's amazed at his treasure, amazed that there are other engineers out there in the world who think just like him, who so meticulously write down all this technical stuff for others to read. He's the only one with the big picture. Of course, he shares much of what he knows with his friends. It's only fair to give something back to Julio. And doesn't Julio share what Mark's told him with John? They're all friends, all members of the Masters of Deception. John is as compulsive as Mark when it comes to TimeNet. He can't resist logging in every day. The only thing that slows him down is the bad power supply in his building. Sometimes John's computer blows a fuse. TimeNet has become MOD's new playground. The hackers are just like a bunch of excited four-year-olds, running around and trying all the rides at once. Every day, it seemed, the MOD boys were finding a new expanse of the network to explore. One day, someone, it might have been John, found this weird list of subnets stored on one of the PDP-10s. The list says Honeywell, Northrop, Loading Dock. It sounded funny. Honeywell and Northrop, they were in the newspapers. Big businesses, right? Something to do with the defense industry? But Loading Dock, what the hell was that? Some kind of multinational shipping concern? Or perhaps a purveyor of pressurized bulkheads? There was one way to find out. The PDP-10 tells them how to get into the Loading Dock host. Log in as Colors. The password is Rainbow. How can they resist? The MOD boys connect, but instead of seeing verification that they've entered Loading Dock, they see something very different on their screens. The host they've cracked is called Dockmaster. They learn that Dockmaster is maintained by the National Computer Security Center, under the jurisdiction of the National Security Administration. The NSA makes the CIA look like lightweights, as any aficionado of spy books could tell you. The agency is so top secret that until recently, the government didn't even admit it existed. It's well known that the NSA earns its keep by monitoring the communications of the world, from telephone taps to satellite traps. And here was a bunch of kids in Queens spying on them. Anyone could see they were getting into war games territory here, but the MOD boys venture further. The authorized user who owns the Colors account happens to be an Air Force general, which the boys learn, well, by reading his electronic mail. The general is in a Dockmaster access group called AF, which they figure stands for Air Force. They snoop around, and to tell the truth, it gets boring. The general doesn't have access to anything that interests them. In fact, the whole experience gives Mark the creeps. He calls it spook stuff and vows to stay away. because he's much more interested in the information pipelines, how information flows through the TimeNet system, than he is in the information itself. That's one big difference between Mark and John. John likes to sit and watch packets of information as they zip through TimeNet. He has started to research the names of the companies listed on the PDP-10s to see what kind of business they do and whether their transactions are worth more than a look. It was easy for him to dismiss Chiquita Banana or Florsheim Shoe Company, but there were dozens of company names he had to look up in Dun & Bradstreet. One morning on the phone, while a Secret Service agent surreptitiously listens in, John tells Julio about a whole list of TimeNet customers that he found while scanning the network the previous night. He says he found 1,000 new computers belonging to such customers as Sealand Services, Black & Decker, Exxon, the Department of Motor Vehicles in California, and the administrative offices for the U.S. court system. John also says he found computers that belonged to Randolph Air Force Base. "Oh, God," says Julio. "We've just got to start hitting those sites left and right." "That's what I plan on doing," says John. John, Julio, Alan, and Eli have become fascinated by the possibilities of TRWNet, for reasons that are different from Mark's. Now, instead of possessing a couple of TRW accounts culled from social engineering or bulletin boards, a couple of accounts that could be discontinued at any given moment, suddenly MOD had the whole list of accounts. It was getting pretty intense, all this power. They could look at whoever they want. A guy who Eli says his dad is thinking of suing. A guy in Brooklyn who has a car Eli wants to buy and find out confidential facts. It was unfortunate that simply having the authority to change credit reports didn't give them the necessary knowledge to actually do it. They'd been thinking that Mark might have figured out how to change TRW credit information. You know, clear up a bad credit history or make someone's good credit background lousy. If Mark had that knowledge, he wasn't saying. One day on the phone, Alan and John talk about whether another friend named Matt has gotten a TRW manual to help them. "Did you talk to Matt? Did you ever find out how to put the delinquencies on?" asks Alan. "He forgot to bring it," says John. "I'm really going to get on him about that. He has the complete instructions to do anything."
"Oh, yeah?"
"Yeah," says John. "I'm talking about everything. He didn't have the bullshit thing that the customers get. He has the admin manual, and he keeps forgetting. It says how to remove them, how to add them, how to do all types of comments to destroy people's lives or fix them. You know, make them look like saints."
"Yeah? Destroy people's lives? Make them look like saints? Is this what hackers do?"
When Mark was not around, the less scientific members of the MOD family still liked to look up celebrities. They collected celebrity credit histories like baseball cards. Now it was so much easier than it once was. One Tuesday night at 10:21 p.m., Eli phones Julio. "So I was looking up a whole bunch of famous people," Julio says.
"Yeah?"
Eli says. "What'd you get? Anybody good?" "I got, who's that? Richard Gere."
"Does he have anything good?" asks Eli.
"Well, I mean, they all have good stuff. I didn't get it to get their credit cards, you know."
"I know," says Eli.
"I have Tony Randall," says Julio.
"You ever get a social security number on that?"
"Yeah," says Julio. "But like, I'm always at a loss with who to look up, you know? I looked up Julia Roberts, but I don't know if she has an apartment in New York City, because I came up with, like, a million of them."
"How'd you get Richard Gere's address?"
"Because, well, it was obviously him, because he was, like, employed by Paramount Pictures or something." Sometimes the MOD boys lurk silently in TimeNet's administrative accounts, watching technicians even at the moment when they were changing the daily passwords. Lots of times they staked out the network and would know the password of the day before some nits of a technician. And then they'd watch him as he tried to use yesterday's discontinued login.
Duh.
Mark, Julio, and John could read the TimeNet security department's email, so they could scan highly sensitive memoranda, bulletins, and alerts about TimeNet security. That way they always stayed a step ahead. They knew about any new security devices well before the devices were put into use. Of course, none of this was happening in a vacuum. TimeNet was well aware of intrusions into the system, and had been ever since the day months ago when Southwestern Bell noticed John and Julio on their switches. TimeNet knew that intrusions into the system were not uncommon. TimeNet was biding its time. Even if TimeNet were ignorant of the intrusions, Chris and Scott called security administrators every day. The ComSec crew knew all about MOD's doings, even got a glimpse of where they were going when they raided ModNet and found some how-to-hack TimeNet files. "These guys are all over you," he says. The TimeNet guy seems very interested. Chris says they can work out a deal. "Well, you know you guys are so wide open.
we're going to have to go to our clients and say, your links to TimeNet are a weakness. The TimeNet official tries to dissuade Chris from making those calls and promises that TimeNet is already working to patch the holes. Oh, no, you're not, says Chris. We know exactly how weak you are, and here's proof. And then he faxes the TimeNet guy some of the files ComSec got from ModNet. That convinces the TimeNet official to make a deal. In exchange for ComSec's silence, he offers Chris and Scott a user ID to make free phone calls through TimeNet. The Texans accept it and use the ID to call European chat systems where they gab with hackers. That was part of their job, gathering information on how hackers work. The network user ID is T.CDS01, which stands for TimeNet ComSec Data Security Number 1. Way cool. Chris and Scott also devoted a lot of time to tracking MOD's forays through TimeNet. Hey, it's a living. And called the TimeNet official pretty often just to say, look what MOD is doing now. ComSec was determined to crush the MOD boys any way possible. They wanted to hurt them. It was all about business, they told people. It was bad for business whenever MOD made ComSec look silly. Like the time when John posted Scott Chasen's mom's credit history where everyone could read it, right on an electronic bulletin board that thousands of hackers log into. The credit report listed Scott's mom's home phone number and address, as well as the phone numbers and addresses of some of her neighbors. John also posted some sexual comments about Scott's mom, for good measure. Right at the top of the record, it said that the information came from Information America, a system the MOD boys reached through TimeNet. Scott didn't like to think about what his mom would say if she ever heard about this incident. Chris didn't like to think about what ComSec's clients would say. This was definitely bad for business, Chris said. More calls ensued from Texas to TimeNet. The Texans were starting to make pests of themselves, though, and the TimeNet security department was starting to dread the calls. Wouldn't you? It was never good news. Soon the Texans were connected with another security officer, a senior investigator with TimeNet named Dale Drew. Drew had once run a bulletin board of his own, using the handle The Dictator. The Dictator had been an underground informant in Operation Sundevil. All the MOD boys had heard the rumors in the underground that TimeNet was hiring the Dictator because of his intimate knowledge of hackers' habits. In this case, however, he knew whenever the MOD boys were in his system, simply because they taunted him. They couldn't help it. Maybe because he used to run a BBS, they thought he was an ex-hacker. Maybe they thought that made him a player in a game called Computer Intrusion. Maybe because the Dictator was an underground informant for Operation Sundevil, they declared a free-for-all. Some game. In any case, Dale Drew would win if he kept the MOD boys out. They'd win if they got in. All good fun. The MOD boys believed that Dale Drew was logging into electronic bulletin boards anonymously, trying to insinuate himself into MOD, trying to get information about just how much the hackers knew about how TimeNet works. In any event, the MOD boys were retaliating by telling Drew that they could read his electronic mail. They told him they could read his memos to his bosses. They even told him they could read the new passwords he used to try to secure the TimeNet system from them. They were trying to drive him crazy. The MOD boys believed that Dale Drew, in return, was gunning for them. They believed that Dale Drew was creating new passwords for the TimeNet system that referred to MOD specifically. One morning, on the phone, John and Julio talked about the Dale Drew situation. What a moron, says Julio. John asks Julio to give him Dale Drew's password. Julio says the password has been changed. So he goes to look it up. Julio tells John he knows at least one new TimeNet password, though not necessarily Drew's password. The password is PHIB*SUX! Julio reads off. 5*sucks? John thinks about this. Fiber sucks, he says. Yeah, Julio says. Fiber sucks. Yeah. John can't believe it. Fiber sucks. Sure sounded to him like TimeNet was playing along. What a strange game. 14. It is the freshest thing Julio has ever seen, and he can't take his eyes off the TV screen. What did the announcer call it? A sky car. For a moment, Julio loses himself in its two-seated splendor. For an instant, he's no longer a kid sitting in front of cable TV in the Bronx, watching an episode of Beyond Tomorrow on the Discovery Channel. The California-born sky car has just been unveiled at the Essen Motor Show in Germany after 25 years of development. Julio imagines himself in the pilot seat as the sky car zips past on the screen. For an instant, he doesn't hear the mice in the kitchen. He only hears the roar of the engines as the sky car lifts off vertically, like a rocket. He sees himself 20,000 feet in the air, guiding the two-seat, car-size airplane wherever he wants to go, and Julio wanted to go a lot of places. He'd been to Peru with his mother, which was pretty fresh, too. But can you imagine the possibilities? Anywhere you wanted to go. It was like hacking into TimeNet, punching a couple of numbers, a couple of letters, and you got to go to a computer in Canada or something. You were in Canada. Or were you? It didn't seem that way to Julio. You were just in another computer. You were still in the Bronx, but in a sky car. You could really go to Canada if you wanted. And when you got there, you could slowly lower it down into a tight parking space. And it would be so awesome. Yeah, right. Where was Julio going to get the money? He didn't even have the money to buy a damn pair of shoes. His mom was out of work, so she wasn't buying him any either. Julio's 18th birthday was coming up this week, but he didn't expect any presents, let alone a sky car. It was funny how things work. There you were, obsessing about a tiny airplane that could take you to the stars, wondering how you'd ever get that kind of money, when the phone rings. An opportunity comes looking for you. The MOD cowboys have ridden where no one else has ever gone before in cyberspace, and they brought back tales of the riches they've seen. A lot of people could put MOD's knowledge to profitable use. It was only natural, of course, that word got around, and it was only natural that people would want to pay to learn how to get some of those riches for themselves. Of course, offering a hacker money for information was a rather delicate proposition. It was one thing to joke around about selling computer information. It was another thing altogether to actually do it. For starters, you had to be sure you were making the offer to a receptive audience. No way would anybody offer Mark a penny for anything. He would look at you as if you were some kind of moron. He didn't sell what he knew. If he liked you, he told you what he knew, free. If Mark didn't like you, well, he'd let you know it. And Paul was no good. He hadn't even been hacking into TimeNet. And even if he had been, he wouldn't sell information either, because that would contradict the hacker ethic that he believed so fervently. And Eli? He didn't know enough to sell anything. Besides, he'd never replaced his computer after the raids. No, if you wanted to approach the masters of deception, you had to do it carefully. You had to make the right move on the right guys. On the hungry guys. If you wanted to approach MOD, use a middleman who was familiar with the players. Somebody who knew the situation. Somebody like Alfredo. And some guy named Morty had been persistently bugging Alfredo, calling him all the time, asking him to broker the deal. Morty has money. Alfredo knew who to approach. He knew, for instance, that Julio had been telling people that he was pulling confidential credit information for a private investigator. Who knew if that was true? But the fact that Julio was saying it said something about him, didn't it? Alfredo became Morty's go-between. It happened in late November of 1991. It was as easy as this. Alfredo calls Julio about 2 o'clock on a Monday afternoon. Julio's already on his other phone line, chatting with a friend about getting together later to hang out. No monster does homework after school, so there's a lot of free time to fill. Julio puts his friend on hold to answer the phone. Julio? Alfredo says. Yeah? Anyway, listen. What? This Morty. Yo, man, I went to his house. He's fucking punk, Alfredo says. This guy got money. Yeah, I know. Parmaster already told me about this guy, Julio says. Oh, yeah? What'd he say? He said this guy is like, he's like one of you. He, like, goes into your money-making schemes, Julio says.
Yeah, but they work.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I already heard about it. Like, Pa already told me he could set me up with this guy to make, like, thousands. I was like, whatever you say, because I don't go for that stuff. Cool playing, Julio. He wants to talk to you, Alfredo says. He told me. Let me talk to someone in MOD. But you can even be the middleman. You know what he wants to buy? Yeah, I know exactly. Plane tickets, right?
No.
Oh? What? He wants to buy an Information America account. So there was the deal then. Morty Rosenfeld needed an Information America account so that he could pull up credit histories. That way he could get people's credit card numbers. What would he do with the credit card numbers? Morty wasn't saying. Morty was no stranger to buying and selling credit information. In fact, the past summer, the feds had charged Morty with selling a password to the credit records company Credit Bureau Index to somebody who'd used it to obtain credit card numbers that were used to order electronics equipment. Morty had been into the hacking scene for about 5 years. He'd gotten his start at age 15 as a member of some gang called Force Hackers. Morty now has a crazy-ass plan to build and sell his own version of IBM personal computers, the Rosenfeld 1000SX, the ultimate hacker's box. All he needed was to come up with a way to buy lots of computer parts, components he would fit together to create the machines. Morty lives over in Coney Island. In fact, Parmaster is staying with him. Well, actually, Parmaster was staying with him until the authorities caught up with the fugitive sleeping on a fold-away bed in Morty's living room. Parmaster had been arrested about 10 days ago. The feds told Parmaster they wanted to ask him some new questions. Over the past couple of months, TRW had reported unauthorized intrusions into credit files, and it seemed the unknown intruder had routinely checked the credit report of Parmaster's mom. Parmaster's arrest hasn't slowed down Morty, though. Julio is intrigued by the possibilities of working with Morty. Maybe he was feeling sorry for himself about his birthday and no money. He doesn't let Alf know any of this, of course. He puts Alf on hold. This is where the negotiations start to get pretty complicated, as Julio switches back and forth between Alfredo and his friend on the other phone line. This is how Julio firms up the deal. Watch him work. The feds do. He's good. Julio switches over to the line with his friend and says, "You won't believe who called me up." "Alfredo," Julio confirms. "Yo, he got dough up the butt now. You want to make some money today?" "How?" asks his friend. "Remember those InfoAm accounts that I was pulling for that PI guy?"
"Yeah."
"Okay, this guy wants to buy one off me for $400.
"Alfredo?"
"Not Alfredo. Come on," Julio says. "Wake up."
"Tell him to shut the fuck up."
"And he'll give you $400 for one?" Julio's friend is incredulous.
"Yeah, for an InfoAmerica account,"
Julio says.
"Oh, my God."
Julio puts his friend on hold and switches back to Alfredo. Julio's playing the convince me game. "I don't want to do anything with this guy."
"Oh, you don't?" asks Alfredo.
"No, I don't think so."
"Why not?"
"Because, like, I don't like dealing with this. And, like, I've already been offered it by, like, many other people. And I, you know, why do it with him when I could have done it with, like, a million other people?"